Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
And welcome back to the Masters of Modern. I'm your host, Alex Kessler, here with my co-host, Ben Bateman.
What's up, everybody?
And today we have the wonderful Paul Rietzel on Skype joining us today. How's it going, Paul?
Very well, guys. Nice to meet you both, and nice to be here. I'm excited to talk with you about modern and all sorts of things magic.
Yeah, man, this is cool stuff. We saw you last at Grand Prix Vegas, and it was cool to have this conversation over a game of magic, and now to see it fully actualized. You're on the Masters of Modern podcast with us. Very, very exciting day for us.
Yep, long time coming.
So we kind of want to talk to you about a few things today, maybe like team-sponsored magic, kind of your history as a pro player, and then we do want to touch on your Naya Company deck that you did very well with recently in a Modern Grand Prix. What was that, 3 weeks ago, something like that, 4 weeks ago?
Something like that, yeah. It was pretty recently in Charlotte.
Yeah, did you and Kibler play the same deck or closely, or was you and Sperling played the same
deck? Me and Sperling, yeah. Yeah, Kibler, I think it picked up Naya Company, dismissed it, and went with something else. And then I developed this Naya Company deck that Matt ended up playing as well. And I think he went 12-3.
Yeah, yeah. Collected Company is a powerful card.
That is true.
I'm a fan. I've been building with that card for a little while. So it's exciting to see it be successful. So let's kind of get into you as a Magic pro. I pulled up your article from TCG Player right after you won Pro Tour Amsterdam back in 2010.
Okay.
And it's a pretty lengthy article, but it's like it starts out with you just being like, I think it was Paul Rietzel was known as a guy who put himself in position to lose important matches, is how you started the article or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you give a bunch of examples of close matches, and then obviously the play-by-play of the win. That was 5 years ago. Sort of how have you watched your Magic career develop since getting that monkey off your back?
Well, when I won the Pro Tour in 2010, up to that point, I played in a lot of, you know, Pro Tours, Grand Prix, high-level events, and I'd been in a position to do pretty well. But I found myself losing matches pretty frequently towards the end of tournaments. And so, you know, really it wasn't until 2009, 2010, when I came back to the Pro Tour, that I ever had any sustained significant success. Since winning the Pro Tour, you know, I have a full-time job. You know, Magic is more of a hobby of mine. I'm a weekend warrior, but I kind of said to myself, you know, if I'm going to spend the time away from home, away from my fiance and my cats and my bed, if I'm going to fly to these tournaments, I'm going to take it seriously and try to win. And the last 4 or 5 years have been pretty good. And I've especially recently found myself with some pretty consistent, solid success at the Pro Tour and Grand Prix circuit.
That's awesome. How old were you when you got into Magic? What was like the, where did you start? What was your set?
When I first started playing Magic, I was 9, and my first boosters were of Revised, but the hot new set that had just come out was actually the Dark, but I wasn't aware that it had come out yet.
Did you open a Maze of Ith at some point?
I'm sure that I did, although, you know, when you're 9 years old, the big controlling factor in your hobby, you know, pursuing hobbies is cost, and so, you know, I was mainly a purveyor of 4th edition in Fallen Empire, since you could open more cards that way per dollar than if you were trying to get the Dark or Revised boosters.
The beauty is when you talk to people who are like, oh, I played Magic back in the day, the first thing you always ask is, okay, what year was it? And if they're like, yeah, 94, you're like, you've got money. If they're like 95, you're like, you probably have nothing.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately for me, it was like the end of 94, so, you know, already it was like hard to get Revised boosters. Like, they were, you know, maybe $3 when I started playing, and by the end of that year, they were already like $5 or $6, which for a 9-year-old is prohibitive. I mean, that's, you're talking about an impossible barrier of entry.
So. Well, especially back in the 90s. I mean, like, now a bus ride costs $1.50, but back then it was like 25 cents, and you can go
right,
you know, anywhere in the city.
Yeah, and actually, I never would have got into competitive Magic except for, you know, I had $15 to my name, and the first Grand Prix that I played was in 1998, so here I'm 12 or something like that, and I pre-registered for my last $15 for the Grand Prix. And if I had to go to the door, the Grand Prix cost $18, and I wouldn't have been able to play. I would have had to borrow money. So
Any stories from those early years, like the way back competitive Magic scene that come to mind? Like, I don't know, Hall of Famers you played or beat or lost against, anything like that?
Well, I mean, my first sanctioned tournament was Grand Prix Boston in 1998. My first game ever sanctioned Magic, I got a game loss. I presented a 59 card deck because I left my pacifism in my friend's deck when we were playing before the tournament. I also was playing against a full, this is my first game ever of sanctioned Magic. It's a full uniformed Marine was the guy I was playing.
Wow.
One of the Grand Prix. Yeah. And so the second game that we played, he gained infinite life, mana, and something else using an Earthcraft Workhorse Spike Feeder combo with Recurring Nightmare.
Oh, wow.
So that was my introduction to Magic. Actually, a few rounds later, I think I was 3-2 in the Grand Prix, and I played against the man who won the first ever Pro Tour, Michael LeCanto, and I actually was fortunate enough to beat him in my very first tournament. So, of course, I knew who he was, and I was like, you know, I was starstruck, and then, you know, right from there, I was hooked.
I think it's really funny that the Magic is this weird like subculture thing where you can actually sort of be starstruck if you're a Magic player and you play against a Magic pro, but it's such a subculture. It would be so difficult for any, you know, for anybody who doesn't play the game to pull any Magic player out of a lineup, right? I mean, in the history of the game.
Yeah, I mean, we were trying to think like where is, I was having this conversation with John Finkel a couple of years back, like what list is John Finkel? Like, he's not an A-list celebrity or a B-list celebrity or a C-list. And we came up with like, he's like an AF level celebrity. So, yeah, anomalous somewhere, but it's on many tiers down.
Well, he's like also known for that whole debacle with the girl he went on the date with that like wrote the article, and then like the entire nerd community rallied behind John Finkel and was like, he's the chosen one. Who is this woman?
Yeah, I mean, as often happens with situations like that, I think some people probably didn't acquit themselves as well as they would have hoped if they could do it all over again. But I thought that John was extraordinarily magnanimous during that whole procedure. So.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so that's like the 90s. So then how long of a break did you take in Magic before you came back in 2009?
Well, I think, you know, as I started to get deeper into college, it just started to become more difficult to go to the tournaments in such a way that I really had any chance whatsoever of doing well. I skipped a Pro Tour in Paris and the World Championships in Japan, just because I knew I wouldn't be able to prepare and the flights were expensive. And this is before any, you know, players clubs or levels like that. And even if there were, I wouldn't have been a big enough level pro to be a part of them. And you know, you skip a couple of pro tours and then you don't prepare for the ones that you go to. And I fell off the pro tour. I think it was probably in 2005 or something like that. And I basically stopped playing competitive Magic until 2009. 2009, there was a Grand Prix in Los Angeles, and Hall of Fame contender Mark Herberholt sends me messages like, I'm flying to L.A., I'm staying with you, and we're going to play in this Grand Prix in LA. And I had no idea that you know, there was going to be a Grand Prix until a week before, but I ended up finishing like 10th in the Grand Prix and got back on the Pro Tour and haven't missed one since.
Nice. Yeah, that's so you missed my favorite sets of all time then, the Time Spiral block. That's like my favorite moment in Magic. You were out of it for that stretch.
Yeah, I make sure to always hit them up when they're the old set drafts on Magic Online, but that's a dark period for me. I remember when I first kind of ran back into Luis Scott Vargas on the Pro Tour, and he was like a big time celebrity. And I said, I remembered just him as LSV on Magic Online. And I said, hey, you know, like everyone knows your name now. And he's like, well, yeah, I won the last Pro Tour. And I'm like, oh my God, LSV won Pro Tour. I just remember him as this Magic Online guy. And now he's the biggest superstar in the world.
Yeah, that is funny. That transition to online Magic has been so pronounced over the last few years. So you get back in 2009, 2010, and the Pro Tour you won, Amsterdam, that was the extended format, right? So that was the now defunct, debunked extended, which is sort of, in a lot of ways, become modern. I mean, that's...
Right. I mean, modern is the inheritor to the, like, eternal like eternal pro level format.
Well, I was looking at like the deck you played at that pro tour, and then like a lot of the decks you're up against. There's a lot of modern cards in there. I mean, there's a ton of like
the ban list is maybe the biggest difference between then and now.
I mean, there's a Merfolk deck. There was a Jund deck. It looked like there was something close to an Abzan deck. A lot of the same. A lot of the staples are in both, though. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. No. I mean, they kind of went through a long period of time before they found modern, where they were trying to come up with what's the best way to allow people to continue to play with their standard cards, but people who don't have dual lands. And that was one of the many kind of iterations they came up with along the way, which was, I think it was double standard was the nickname they called it back then. Cause it was like the last four blocks plus the corresponding core sets. And yeah, I mean, I guess you could really, I guess that was the father of modern, excuse the phrase.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that, you know, that set of cards would ultimately go on to sort of become what formed the modern format. So back then, were you one of the players, like, I guess most players, I think I was the same way, where you guys would just play extended the season you had to, and otherwise nobody played extended?
You know, honestly, with me personally, I that's the way I play all formats.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, I am, again, because of the way that I approach tournaments, I almost all of the Magic I play, I would say over 95% of the Magic I play is specifically geared towards tournament preparation. So, you know, right now I am basically just playing standard. You know, but before a modern tournament, I'm basically just playing modern. And that's because I don't have enough disposable time to just kind of mess around. I mean, I'll do the occasional cube draft, but I gear almost all of my Magic playing towards getting ready for the next event.
How much IRL Magic do you play versus Magic Online?
None. I never play Magic in real life. The only time I ever play Magic with real cards are at Grand Prix and Pro Tours.
Oh wow, that's so you don't like you do you own cards or you borrow cards or Team Ultra Pro just gives you cards?
No, it's a combination of things. So occasionally I will. You know, like with a set like Khans of Tarkir or like this one, like Magic Origins, I'll purchase the cards ahead of time because I figure, you know, the set's so juiced that I'm going to use these cards so much over the next year that it's worth my time. And I think it'll probably maintain a pretty good resale value. You know, occasionally I'll try to borrow to fill in the holes and you know, I can obviously I have a nice network so I can access whatever cards that I need. But now, I don't maintain, like, there's no other way for me to collect cards other than to just purchase them.
When you are choosing a deck for a tournament, obviously, if it's not a limited tournament, and you, before Team Ultra Pro was a thing, like, how do you identify the deck you want to play? Is it just through testing? You're open to any kind of deck? Or is there a style that you, I was under the impression you sort of gravitated towards aggressive decks. Is that true or is that not true?
It is true to an extent. So the answer to your question is that I do it by losing a lot. I play a lot of different I play a lot of different decks on Magic Online, and I'll just keep losing and losing and losing and losing, and eventually I'll find a deck where I stop losing, and that's usually the deck that I settle on. I do have a preference for aggressive decks, although I find that to be mostly manifested in Pro Tours as opposed to Grand Prix, because Pro Tours are almost they are exclusively new and unexplored formats. And so they usually have circumstances which more lend themselves towards proactive strategies as opposed to trying to figure out what everyone else is doing and responding to that, which is, I think, kind of a tough guessing game.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I'm a player who's much, much more I brew a lot. That's sort of where I love to play Magic, because I like to come up with the wonky things and combine largely bad cards to try to make them good, which rarely works in the competitive scene. But I do recall a few years back, I think it was Avacyn Restored, I feel like, and there was a Grand Prix, and I think you were playing an aggressive deck. I know it had Hellriders in it. I can't remember if it was Mono Red or if it was, like, White Red or something.
Yeah, it was Boros Humans with Hell Riders and Stromkirk Nobles was the deck.
And I just remember watching, I think it was like, I want to say it was like the semis or the quarters. And I just remember watching and you mulled the five, I think. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking at the hand and you were sitting there trying to wonder to keep it or not. And I don't know. It struck me as, I realized I had such a hard time evaluating aggressive strategies versus sort of mid-range or controlling strategies or combo strategies. They're all like way easier for me to wrap my head around, but with aggro, it's like just evaluating a mulligan seems so much more difficult because it's such a simple, simple strategy.
Mm-hmm. I think that aggressive decks reward repetition in practice a lot less than control and combo decks do. You know, like you can just brute force play test a controller or a combo deck until you recognize all the patterns and figure out what's important and know what to mulligan. Whereas aggressive decks, you're going to be faced with different situations every single game, and you need to understand how to apply pressure and, you know, deny your opponent resources, deny them time if that's the important resources, every single game differently. So it tests a different skill set.
Do you, with the new proposed mulligan rules that we're looking at, you guys are going to be using over the weekend actually at the Pro Tour, as a largely, you know, player that preferences aggressive decks, how do you feel about that rule? Is that something that you think is going to benefit your strategy, your style?
I don't think it necessarily benefits aggressive decks necessarily. It's probably a bad rule for me specifically because I think that I was someone who I think gained some of my edge from good mulliganing decisions, and B, I tend to keep more hands than a lot of other higher level pros. And I think that maybe I will probably end up keeping too many hands given the new rules. I think that given the way standard is right now, most of the decks gain a little bit of consistency. And I think some of the decks like a mid-range Abzan deck will lose a little bit of equity with the new mulligan rules, just because part of their, you know, built-in systemic edge was in kind of doing the same thing consistently every game. And now other decks are going to be able to do that a little bit more, but I wouldn't overestimate the impact. It's really kind of a smaller impact than people are kind of making it out to be.
How do you feel about Wizards like really addressing, I guess just largely changing the game, changing the infraction rules, changing things like mulligans? I mean, do you think that the game is in a pretty healthy place, or do you think there's always a lot of room to improve for this game?
Well, I mean, I think that when it comes to those sorts of things, that the organized play changes to the rules, things like the new mulligan rule or the new combat rules, I think that they have a pretty good track record of thinking through these decisions and understanding their implications before going public with them. That I'm at this point, you know, I'm almost 30 years old. I tend to not, you know, be the sky is falling Chicken Little type when they come out with these decisions. So it's funny, you know, sometimes, you know, like this rule, right, the new mulligan rule, on its face, it is blatantly just good for the highest level of player. It's good for the better players. It's bad for worse players because you're gonna reduce the variance in the game. You're going to reduce the amount of non-games. And those are the games in which worse players would have the better chance of beating the better players. And yet, people who are more, you know, amateur or casual players have come out and they love the rules. They love the fact that there's going to be less non-games in Magic. So if the people that it's the worst for like the rule change, it's probably a pretty good sign that you know, Wizards is pretty well attuned to where they should be going with Magic and the rules.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty clever. I think it's a pretty clever addition, just based simply on the fact that like, Scry anything is always awesome. I mean, it's just great. You put that on a card, it's like, oh, this card's immediately better. So it just makes every game of Magic better, it feels like.
Speaking of rule changes to recent Magic, I actually, and you mentioned that you kind of play exclusively Magic the Gathering Online. How do you feel about the new changes to Magic the Gathering Online that Wizards just kind of announced this morning?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had a chance to fully digest it from a mathematical EV standpoint. I know that the current model was completely unsustainable. I tweeted that, you know, basically, you know, pretty soon after a set comes out, the heads up queues become unplayable because there is no win rate that you can maintain to break even in them. So they really shouldn't fire unless someone is not considering their own rational self-interest. So, they had to do something, ultimately, in order for this new economic model to make sense, they're going to need to anchor these play points to some sort of tangible thing that you can get with them besides just entry to tournaments. You know, I think people suggested some sort of a prize wall or something like that. And I think that we're still sort of waiting for all of the details to shake out. But I in general, am just pro action, I guess, when it comes to the Magic Online economy, because it's
already broken.
Yeah. Exactly.
So to kind of explain to everyone out there on the internet what happened, basically Magic Gathering Online used to just reward packs, and it was generally high EV if you won, but you know it was unsustainable based off of just pack economy for how sets would come out eventually. Eventually they become worth less than it's actually worth playing in these 2-mans or 8-mans for Constructed specifically. And recently what they're doing is you're getting less packs, so when you win a tournament you only get 2 packs versus 8, but you also get X amount of these player points that allow you to buy into new tournaments just using those points. And so if you win one of these things, you now get enough points to play in 2. If you lose, you get like 5 points. So like 4 losses equal 1 free tournament. So the idea is to encourage constructed play on Modo. And I mean, anything that makes Modo better is probably better for in the long run, since that is probably one of the biggest glaring misses that Wizards is going through right now.
Well, I think that's what you said is true to an extent. I don't think that this is designed to encourage people to play Constructed on Magic Online. I think the biggest issue what exacerbated already, you know, systemic issues in the Magic Online economy is that people were playing tons of Constructed on Magic Online and not drafting enough. And what that did was create lots of sealed booster packs that never got opened, which flooded the economy with them and crash the prices. So you were ending up with heads up queues that cost 2 tickets to enter and paid 1 pack that was worth 1.71 tickets. And, you know, I mean, obviously, like I said, that's an insane thing. You can't, I mean, when you're talking about 4 tickets of buy-in between the 2 players paying out a total of 1.71 tickets and prizes, that's a off the charts rake. And so, you know, like I said, they're trying to like rejigger the numbers a little bit to come up with a different economic system. I don't know if this fixes any of the kind of root problems, but you know, they had to try something.
So as a guy who you're on Team Ultra Pro now, what's there like 18 or 20 of you guys on the team? Is that about right?
I think that's about right. We probably have somewhere in the 16 to 18 mark that are qualified and going to the next Pro Tour in Vancouver.
So that's a pretty big step. Organized team play from companies that aren't, I mean, you know, that's, that don't just sell Magic cards from an outside sponsor. So being on a team like that and preparing for a tournament like this, you obviously are pretty aware of the landscape of the game as a streaming platform and Magic coverage compared to say other esports, right? Like League of Legends and things like that. You guys have talked about this, I'm sure.
Sure.
So where do you kind of see the next iteration of this going? I mean, do you think that the streaming numbers improving and viewership being higher than ever is just going to continue and we're just trending up? I mean, how does it compare to a game like League of Legends or something else like that?
Well, I mean, the issue with comparing to League of Legends is that Magic coverage, and specifically coverage of high-level play, high-level tournaments, is specifically geared and attractive to people who are already deeply enfranchised players. And it's oftentimes very difficult to get any interest level or enthusiasm to sit down and watch 8 hours of Grand Prix coverage, for example, from someone who's played Magic for 6 months, or, you know, maybe the kind of person who spends $1,000 or $2,000 a year on it. Whereas, you know, League of Legends, because of the visual, you know, anchoring of the sport and the fact that, you know, there are things exploding and noises and whatever, you know, you can, it's more kind of base level entertaining, you know, then sometimes you just watch a Magic game and nothing happens for a minute. You just want to shake the screen, like, what the heck is going on? I don't know, you know what I mean? I've never been a big streamer, and, you know, I've never, you know, tried to rely on Magic or Magic Online as any part of my own personal income. I know that there are people that are really enthusiastic about the future, and I think it'll continue to grow, but it would take some kind of sea change moment, some paradigm shift, for there to be an exponential growth event in Magic Online interest, or Magic viewership interest, I think.
So with like the number of you guys who are, I think you're currently the 6th ranked player in the world. Is that right?
Jeez, I don't know. That could be right. Yeah, I don't know.
Working on a pro Magic team, I mean, what does that mean? How is it? Like, what, I guess, you know, just talk to sort of our audience for a minute. Like, you 6th or 25th or 50th ranked in the world. I mean, it's, that's, there's 26 million players or something like that. So if you're in the top 50, the top 10, and you're on a pro team, what does that look like?
Yeah. So, with Team Ultra Pro and before Team Ultra Pro, I played with Team Channel Fireball, Pantheon. Basically, it's a collaborative work environment that we use to bounce ideas off of each other and play test exclusively for upcoming tournaments. In the case of Team Ultra Pro, you know, what that means is that we have a team forum and a team Facebook group where we seek out, you know, playtest opponents, where we're posting deck lists, where people are commenting and replying to the comments and questioning. And it's kind of a an iron sharpens iron environment or theory where, you know, hey, you know, like I'm going to post a deck list and I'm going to have, you know, Patrick Chapin and Ben Stark and Sam Black and, you know, all these people rip it to shreds. And it's kind of like, you know, presenting a dissertation, you know what I mean? If I can defend my deck list against the dissertation and then play it against all their best decks, there's a pretty good chance that we have a deck that's pretty playable for the tournament. And we use other tools like, you know, Google Hangout. We have Google Hangout meeting tomorrow about Magic Origins, Origins Limited, where, you know, it's not much different than being in a boardroom or a conference room and just kind of discussing and trying to share knowledge to become greater than we would be individually.
Is the dynamic on Team Ultra Pro significantly different than the dynamic that you experienced on Channel Fireball, or does it team to team is pretty similar?
I don't know if the dynamic is different so much as our process is different. You know, Channel Fireball Pantheon arrived in Vancouver today. You know, they're going to be there in kind of the boot camp in the house environment for the next whatever it is. 12 days before the Pro Tour, they're going to skip Grand Prix Dallas. And they're just going to focus on getting ready for this Pro Tour. Our team, you know, because we have a lot of people that have full-time jobs and are, you know, maybe more viewing Magic as a serious hobby than a profession. You know, we use a lot of online collaborative tools, a lot of communication, you know, playing online, that sort of thing. And then we'll probably meet up, you know, maybe a few days before the tournament in Vancouver to do last second preparation, as opposed to, you know, renting a house out in the middle of nowhere to isolate ourselves.
Let's talk a little bit about your collected company deck, man. I think you know, it's a modern deck and it's a modern podcast, and you did very well with it recently. So I think it'd be kind of a fun deck tech to do.
Sure.
All right. So it's basically a Niazu deck that plays collected company, right? That's the premise. Most efficient, like burn and removal with efficiently costed creatures and four copies of collected company.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically in a nutshell. And the idea is that, it adds a sorely missing dimension of both, an instant speed attack as well as a card advantage element to what was otherwise a pretty good, consistent, proactive deck that was just kind of missing that element.
Do you think, so a 4-mana creature that at instant speed that is playable in Modern is Restoration Angel. That's a very good card, right? And you wouldn't play Restoration Angel in a Naya deck or in a Zoo deck necessarily, though I'm sure people have tried. Do you think that the value of 2 versus 1 is so great that it sort of just, it's hard to sort of wrap my head around why Collected Company is in fact so good, even though it's been proven and I've played it and enjoyed it myself. When it was printed, I didn't look at it and my head didn't explode. You know what I mean? It seemed pretty good, but it seems so much better than that when you play it.
Right. Well, if you look at the history of Modern, basically through the very beginning of the format, 4 mana has really been that key mana cost, right? Where, especially if you're going to try to be doing something with the creature type, it either needs to have flash or come into playability at 187 ability, or it needs to protect itself. There are some very, very rare exceptions. I mean, occasionally Jund is played like an Olivia or two. Occasionally, Hero of the Bladehold back in the day, people used to play. But really, it needs to have one of those three things. With the case of Collected Company, obviously you have the flash aspect, which sometimes even adds the come into playability aspect, you know, because you can sometimes ambush a creature that's attacking you or something of that nature. I think that the thing we talk about card collected company is that it's difficult to make any sort of generalizations because it functions so differently in each of the different decks that want to utilize it. You know, in our case, or in the case of the Naya Zoo deck, the point is to put out like 10 power at instant speed or 8 power at instant speed and just overwhelm them with things that, that their removal can't handle. But you know, obviously it's been used in combo decks and merfolk decks and all sorts of different stuff. So it has many, many different applications.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the cards that really jump out in the list. I'm assuming the One Bird of Paradise is just the fifth Noble Hierarch, right? That's the choice there.
Yeah, I had another land for a while, and you know, it just I've been moving back and forth between another land and the Birds of Paradise, it's the fifth Noble Hierarch.
It's because it's more explosive. So the whole like get down a mana creature on turn one and then resolve like a Smiter or a Knight on turn two. That's sort of that, or a Nacatl on turn one is what you want, correct?
Correct. Yeah, those are the best sort of proactive. If they stumble, they're in big trouble type draws that you can have.
How do you nowadays, like, there's so many decks that interact with the graveyard in Modern, both like Goryeo's Vengeance or the company combo deck. I mean, it's the graveyard's a pretty massive part of the format. Do you feel like, because of the awareness of that, you know, the number of oozes that get played, do you think Tarmogoyf is maybe not as powerful as it once was in Modern? Or do you think it's just every bit as good as it has always been?
I definitely think it's not as good as it once was, but I mean, you're talking about you know, the baseline being it was the best card, you know, so or very close to it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So you know, now it's just like a really good card. You know, there are certainly games in which they're able to keep your Tarmogoyf under control, or in which, you know, it's you know, not the most efficient thing you can be doing. But there are plenty of games in which it's just a 4-5 immediately, you know. And in those games, you know, it just blacks out the sun in terms of curve efficiency. And I mean, especially in a deck like this, which is already playing a bunch of big, stupid, dumb monsters, not playing the single most efficient one would be criminal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you famously in that article you wrote for TCG Player talk about the breakthrough that you had the night before the tournament, where you realized you needed to play 4 Relic of Progenitus against the Tarmogoyf deck, right? That's the story. So I definitely think that over time, you know, the graveyard becoming more important is actually worse for Tarmogoyf, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, like Scavenging Ooze right now is one of the better, most prolific answers to Tarmogoyf that most decks, especially ones playing Tarmogoyf, even play main deck because it helps them answer Tarmogoyfs, it helps them answer Tassigers, it helps them deal with the stupid combo decks like Goryeo's Vengeance, not to mention Snapcast. There's so many cards. Like, the graveyard in Modern is as much a part of the resource chain as your hand is in other formats, almost.
Absolutely, yeah. So, looking over the lands here, you've got one Horizon Canopy, which is cool. I mean, I love that card. You have one Kezzik Wolf Run, and these, I'm assuming, the one-ofs are because you have 4 Knight of the Reliquary in here?
Yes, that's correct.
How important of a card was Kezzik Wolf Run to this deck?
Oh, it was huge for me. And I know, talking to Matt, so, you know, anecdotally, he said it won him multiple games that no other card in Magic could have won for him. So, you know, very, very frequently in Modern, people have just like a random Hierarch sitting around, or they're going to, you know, block your 7/7 Knight of the Reliquary with a man land or whatever the case is. And Knight of the Reliquary simultaneously allows you to jump over those threats with Trample. It allows you to go wide when you're getting a volume of creatures in play with Collected Company to kind of pump up the one that they don't have an answer for. And it's your best mitigation for it's your best flood insurance. You know, makes so that if you have 6 lands out and you sack one of them and go get a Kessick Wolf Run, all of a sudden you're getting a value out of that 6th or 7th land that you're drawing. So We Sam Black actually, and we talked about maybe having Scarred Rage Pits for some period of time, but ultimately the upside of Wolf Run was just too good. It's overperformed for us.
So what would you say some of the, like, flaws for this deck was? What are kind of the roadblocks that you ran into during the GP and moving forward? What kind of things would you think that this deck would have trouble with?
So I lost two matches, one of which was to my own idiocy, and then the other one was to just red-green Tron, which is just inherently, I think, probably a slightly bad matchup. I mean, obviously, game one is fairly hopeless because they're just going to be able to, between Wurmcoil Engine and Oblivion Ring, and Ursa, Oblivion Stone, rather, and all the different cards that are a nightmare for us. It's very difficult for us to win game one when we can't interact with their lands. And then game two, you know, we're going to have to try to find one of those ways to mess with their Urzatron, or we're going to lose that one too. So the big mana decks, whether it's Red-Green Tron or Amulet Bloom, those are going to be kind of more difficult matchups. And then, other than that, you have pretty good game against all of the mainstream sort of decks. I mean, every now and then someone's going to show up with something like Storm or Ad Nauseam or something like that, which are just an abysmal matchup for you. But like, we played the deck assuming that those would be more fringe type decks than heavily played.
What are the different processes you go through? Like, what kind of different choices would you make picking a deck for a Pro Tour versus picking a deck for a GP?
Well, I know you mentioned... I think Ben mentioned that you're more of a brewer at heart, and I'm very much the opposite. I'm much more of a tuner at heart. So the way in which I most enjoy, you know, Magic is to look at all the decks that are succeeding, look at the metagame, as a whole, and try to figure out, okay, what's a good way to approach this? What beats what other people are doing? You know, how do I take maybe one of these, you know, well-performing decks and, you know, mess with the mana base or add a card people haven't thought of or move some numbers around in order to make it, more to my liking and more appropriate for a tournament. And that sort of approach is very effective for Grand Prix because they're frequently established formats that have been iterated, no pun intended, ad nauseum. And all of the decks are known and very infrequently do completely brand new archetypes just emerge at the Grand Prix level. So I like to pick an established deck and give it my own kind of tweak. For Pro Tours, if I'm going to be completely honest, it's super important for me to be a part of a high level team. I think I wouldn't have had nearly the success that I've had without having that sort of support structure, because I rely on the Patrick Chapins and the Gabriel Nassifs and the Sam Blacks of the world to put together these shells. And then my expertise is to pick them and to try to sharpen them and to figure out what their weaknesses are and work on the sideboards and the 58th and 59th and 60th cards. Because if I were faced with the task of trying to brew a new deck in 2 weeks for a Pro Tour, I would never do well.
Your list here, the Collected Company, I misspoke earlier when I said 4 Collected Company. You played 3. How long did it take in testing to establish that 3 Collected Company was correct instead of 4?
Actually, if you look at if you look at some of the decks that have been doing well on Magic Online that were playing Collected Company with Wild Mikado, a lot of them actually had 2. The first things that I changed was to try out a third and a fourth Collected Company. The issue with the Collected Company is that there's two main issues. The first one is obviously the mana cost. You're playing a deck that is a beatdown deck on a fundamental level. So if you draw multiple Collected Companies, it's probably going to interfere with your curve in the early turns of the game. And the second thing is that it's the opportunity cost, right? Like, if you assume that you have to lock in 4 Bolt and 4 Path because of the most effective removal suite available to your color combination, and if you assume that your lands are locked in stone, then the fourth Collected Company is going to have to cut a creature, which is then going to decrease the effectiveness of your Collected Company. So, I tried 4 for a little while. I settled on 3. I don't have a high confidence, I don't have a high level of confidence that that's the right number. And it's certainly possible that you could put in a 4th, but that's kind of where we settled for that tournament.
All right. So normally we take these decks and put them through a kind of a best of the format gauntlet. So I'm going to throw some decks out to you, and if you can kind of break down how you would handle playing against those decks using the sideboard and how the deck plays in general to kind of how you would beat it, or if it's just a bad matchup and you'd try dodging it using the power of pairings.
We'll just roll through like four or five of them.
So for to kind of represent aggro, Affinity.
Yeah, Affinity is a not a great matchup game one. Obviously, we have four Bolt, four Path, three Pride Mage, and the collected companies that can reach them. So we can certainly fight, but it's this disadvantageous game one. You know, obviously games two and three, we stocked our sideboards with Katakis and Stony Silence and Bonfire of the Damned, and it becomes very, very, very favorable post board. You know, overall in a three-game match, it's a deck that we would like to face in the tournament because of how strong our sideboard is. And I think I was 2-3-0 against Affinity in the Grand Prix. So it's a good matchup.
Moving next, mid-range control shell. So Jund and/or Abzan.
Slightly different. Both I would say are favorable. Jund is more favorable than Abzan. But you know, in both, you know, you're talking about being able to kind of get under them by being a more fast and aggressive beatdown deck, but then we can get over them with collected companies. So I was undefeated against both those decks in the Grand Prix. I have very, very good records against them online. Decks that you definitely would want to face in the tournament. Surprisingly enough, Thalia is actually a pretty effective sideboard card against both of them because they usually, when they see that you're playing a Nakadal, Knight of the Reliquary deck, they turn into like a pure control removal deck, and Thalia can be super, super annoying.
All right. Tebow combo with Twin.
Yeah, that's a really good matchup. So the thing about Twin decks historically against these sorts of Niazu decks is that they don't handle the pressure very well when their creatures are unable to enter combat with your creatures. And like when you're putting a turn two smiter out, you know, they're going to be forced to like blow their Deceiver Exarchs to just kind of buy their turn of tapping down a smiter. You know, Exalted is a great way to force through damage. You have plenty of removal between Bolt and Path to handle their creatures. And then obviously you've got, Pride Mage as well to keep them off the combo. So, you know, obviously it's Twin, you know, it's one of the pillars of the format, and they can obviously always beat you if you have a bad draw or if they just go for it and you don't have a removal spell, but it's definitely a favorable matchup.
All right. Control. So either the Tron and or the Grixis lists.
Or blue, white, red. I mean,
yeah.
Okay. Family. Well, those are,
all three different
very
matchups.
Different. The Grixis deck is the single best matchup for this deck. So Patrick, who played Grixis to also a 13-2 record, said that he went like something like 0-13 in playtesting against Naya Company during his before the tournament games. So Grixis is the deck that you want to play against all different kinds of Grixis. Red, white, blue. So, like, the Snapcaster Lightning Helix deck is actually a poor matchup. That's not a deck that you want to face. You do not want to be getting your Nicodles, Snapcaster Helix. So, yeah, you're definitely hoping if they lead with a Steam Vents that their next turn is a Polluted Delta.
All right, and last but not least, the non-interactive combo. So, Amulet.
Yeah, so, again, you know, this is another – these are bad matchups. You do not want to play against the big mana decks. You do not want to play against Amulet. The problem is that we're not an all-in pure beatdown deck. We have enough of a mid-range element with Knight of the Reliquary and Smiter that we allow them too much time to kind of set up. So we're going to be heavily reliant on getting one of our mess with all of your non-basic lands cards post-board and try to steal those games from them. But definitely a matchup that we want to fade.
Okay. All right. What do you, and the most unfair deck in the format right now seems to be the Goro's Vengeance deck. That's the one that everybody's talking about. Is like that's the banning deck. Have you played against it very much?
You know what? I don't even know what's in it, honestly, because it didn't really exist on Magic Online prior to the Grand Prix, and I haven't played a game of Modern since Grand Prix Charlotte. So, you know, my gut feeling is that it's a bad matchup. Although we do have enough ways to get kind of an ooze out. pretty quickly that maybe there's some chance of competing with it, but I would guess it's not favorable, but I don't know.
All right, great. So before we get into the ending of everything, I do want to remind everyone, because we ask everyone on Twitter a question and they send us answers to it. So to remind everyone, our Twitter is at the MMCast. I said, what card is going to see the most play at Magic Origins in general from Standard? So first we have at Jeffrey Murphy. He said Nissa, and it's not going to be close.
Should be pretty good.
next, Alex Hallowen. His at Alex is Banana Man, way easier to say. Demonic Pact, because it'll be hilarious. I mean, I've seen people trying to mess with the deck, a card. I don't get it.
It looks cool. I mean, it'll be funny. I don't know.
Richard Blakely, I'm gonna have to say Chandra, because you can get her out by turn three and easily deal damage in fast red decks.
All right.
Chris Connery, the new Jace. Just period.
I don't think the new Jace is good.
Actually, I played a cube with him recently, and that was my like first experience playing with him. And he bought back like four Heroes Downfall.
Wow.
Throughout the game. I mean, yes, it was like a longer tournament, but like just getting twice is pretty good card advantage. The trigger.
Do you have any strong opinions on any of the new Planeswalkers, Paul?
Well, you know, I do, but you know, it's difficult to give too much information because
it's coming up.
Testing period. I will answer the question though, if you're interested in what card I think will see the most play from the new set.
All right, go for it.
Yeah,
my personal opinion is Languish. I think that is the card that's going to see the most play. I think that Magic Origins. It's like as if I needed another reason to play Siege Rhino and Passinger. They printed Languish. So I look forward to having all of my creatures destroyed by Languish many, many times.
Fair enough. Well, I would say that pretty much wraps us up for the day. We want to thank you so much for coming by. This was an awesome conversation we got to have.
Yeah. We, as I just mentioned, we are at the MMCast. I am at Kess Wiley.
And I'm at Ben Bateman Media. Paul, where can the folks find you?
You can find me at Paul Rietzel. If you can spell my last name, you will find me there.
It's IETZL?
IETZL, that is correct.
And we'll make sure if you go to rocketjump.com, you can see the links to your Twitter, and we'll probably post the deck list from today and maybe the article Ben mentioned. And we kind of don't always say this, but make sure to check out our sister podcast, The Command Zone. They do awesome Commander content. You guys should go check them out. They're the best. So that's it. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming by, Paul.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com. See you later, alligator.